play a bit of footsie, don't we, sometimes?
It's too long. I could probably, yeah. Could.
We're both like, I'm trying to just extend.
Can you imagine I'm like deep into review and slowly your foot.
I should just do it and you should just ignore it.
You should just like scratch my ear and I'm like, thank you.
I'll like offer you a tissue or something. Yeah. Thank you. Get a mug and just like.
So you've come back from New York?
I have, yeah.
Welcome.
I cannot say this with enough respect for Americans. I think they're fantastic. But especially in New York, they're not real people. What do you mean? Walk around and see just the things that they say and the way that they engage. I'm like, this is a set. This isn't real.
New York to be New York.
When you hear people talk, it sounds like AI is making procedurally generated dialogue. Like you cannot
These
possibly.
These are non-playable characters.
Your non-playable characters. You are the thing from the back of that movie.
Wow.
You know what I did see in New York, which I thought was really cute, is this was in like some trendy area in Williamsburg. I saw a sort of old-time cinema. Apart from the posters for The Flash and Spider-Verse and Fast 10, it looked like a film theater that could have been in the 1930s. Mm. And it made me realize something really specific about American cinemas is they have the box office ticket outside the cinema.
Yes.
And people queue outside. Uh-huh. And I just think that's adorable. Yes. Whereas in the UK, it's like a dark multiplex deep inside like a yes. larger complex.
I think you might have done in the olden days. Do you remember in Empire of Light, they showed the concession yes. stand was kind of... In
the middle of yeah. the thing.
Well,
but,
no, sorry, that's the ticket
you're right,
stand.
The ticket thing was out there, yeah.
At the door. I was talking to my dad about this recently because I was basically, I can't remember if we started this conversation on this show, but like if you look at the way that obviously cinema consumption has changed in the past 50 years in that if you wanted to see a film, films did not exist at home 50 years ago. They were shown on TV, but they were shown chopped up with adverts.
And it was like more of an event, like, oh, they're showing this
But also,
film. Maybe
TV,
Christmas.
TVs were shit in the 70s.
Yes.
Like,
it fuzzy. Was
rubbish.
Yeah.
And you think, why would I want to stay and watch it? I would rather go. So
soaps.
Right. So you would go and see films. That was the place where you saw films primarily.
Yeah.
And now the situation is inverted. Right?
Completely.
I'm sure most people watch their films at home.
Yeah.
With the exception
people
of cinema.
People are happy to wait.
Exactly, but I was talking to my dad about it, and I was talking to him about that sort of era, you know, of going to see things, and he said, yeah, but what you don't realise is the only way that you could know film, what was on at the cinema, was in the local weekly paper, right?
Crazy.
And you would check it, and there was you couldn't, like, pre-book tickets online. The only way to get a ticket, you couldn't turn up, like, buy a ticket the day before. You had to turn up in time and queue. And sometimes you'd get a bus, sometimes two buses, sometimes three buses.
Like in Seinfeld, they would queue out to the...
You get there and they say, sorry, sold out. You wait in line, you get to the thing, sorry, sold out. And that's your evening. And then you go home.
Yeah.
That is insane. And now...
They're choosing your seat online.
Just contrast that with us sat on the sofa, flicking through the carousel, going, no, I don't think I fancy that.
Flicking through all the content ever.
Yeah.
Like all content
churlish of us.
And we're like, there's nothing to watch.
Yeah.
Choice is the worst thing that ever happened to content.
Yeah. Well, wow, that's profound.
Profound,
wow.
Yeah.
Yes. Did you say that? Or did someone else say that?
No, I just came up with it. But somebody did say it.
Mm.
But
I mean, it's a fact. It's,
yeah.
It really, isn't
it's
it?
Not the most amazing.
Not that I don't want you to take the credit for it, but I just want to make sure that we don't.
No, it's like, it means that nothing appeals.
Yeah. The paralysis of choice. It's a famous thing in consumer capitalism.
But like, we know, like I said, you'll watch Seinfeld and you'll see them queuing outside to go to the movie theater. And like, hey, I've seen this movie. What do you want to see?
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought, oh, that's a really nice, cozy thing that looks like a set from a movie, but is actually, you see it in real life. I'm like, yeah, that's a
thing. I know what you mean about New York, though. It's kind of like hyper real. It's hyper reality because it's almost like New York has generated as a cornerstone of culture so much music, film, TV references that has almost then become so big that has then informed and influenced the life that people now walk around just thinking they're in Sex and the City or Friends or whatever. And interesting.
Yeah.
An interesting time, but what a great city. If we have any New York listeners.
Oh yeah.
Please. I feel like they're too busy.
I
can't listen to that right now.
I gotta go.
I gotta walk my dog.
Speed.
Yeah. Please.
Yeah. I had loads of deli foods. I sent you a video when I was in a deli. I had pizza every day.
You were Brendan Fraser levels of eating pizza.
Yeah.
I was worried that you'd have to roll back in here.
Yeah. I really did like, you know, I'd probably unbutton the top thing of the jean. I had a pizza that was 20 inches, could easily feed 4 men for lunch. But I just, it was great.
I mean, and I'd love to do it, but I feel like it's more the feeling of after 2 days, your body's just like, look, I love this, but can I have something that's like organic matter?
Vegetables.
Can I have one vegetable, one broccoli, one stem of broccoli?
On like the fourth day, like Tanya got this salad, which was like, had like roasted Brussels sprouts and broccoli. And I remember like I had a bit of broccoli and it was really good. And I could just tell my body was like, yes, this is what, this is what is all this vitamin C?
Digest every cell of this plant because we're going to need it.
After just like endless cheese and tomato and pepperoni. The best I got was a bit of like spring onion and ramen.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Which they call... They don't call spring onions in America, do they?
No.
They're called like scallions.
Oh, scallions, that's it.
Yeah. Ha. Huh. While you've been away, we obviously had an episode go out about Beau's Afraid. And we put out some of the games that came from that episode. Oh, I just want to just do some any other business.
Just reiterate the game that we played.
So just look, I posted on Instagram the game, which was...
great game. Did really well.
It was okay game. It was... What was the title of it? It was... Oh, yeah. One-syllable movie. You, it was your game to me. You gave it to me last week.
Really simple, just impossible to know before
very
you go
difficult
in.
To do. And I was staggered at the amount of people...
Wait, but sorry. Just when... Usually when we play these games online, which I think is great, people chime in with all the things we didn't get.
Please.
And I'm like, oh, fantastic. All of these answers.
And you know, I don't normally call people out. I'm not going to name these people. I'm just intrigued by. I don't think these are listeners. I think these are the wider.
And just because I now know we need to clarify, George, what is a syllable?
Well, a syllable
word.
The OED version of it. The OED syllable.
Are we just more musically inclined than?
I think syllables, but you learn that in English, not in. Syllable. Can I?
George is googling. Just gonna fix
How do you?
S-Y-L-L-A-B.
Oh, yeah. I've just not written that.
Yeah, no, why would you?
A unit of pronunciation having one vowel sound with or without surrounding consonants forming the whole or a part of a word. For example, there are two syllables in water.
I like to think
and three in inferno. Right, there we go.
I like to think of it as how many times does your mouth move? So like, hello.
Yes.
It's two.
Yes.
Once. My mouth did one thing.
And
nope.
Here are some of the comments we got on that game. There's no way brave is one syllable. Explain, James.
No idea. I think the BR might be something that's thrown them there, like brave.
Brave?
But like, not that anyone ever says it like
is
that.
Is brave?
Yeah.
Cars is two syllables. If it was car, it'd be one.
Yep,
it would be
plurals
one.
Plurals there.
Cars.
And then I love when someone got three. Meg,
yes.
Ted,
yes.
Seven.
Seven.
Yeah. And I think you just thought of one word titles.
And then someone was like, drive, yes. Dune, yes. Nope, yes. Fury, no. Carry, no. And then the person says, carry, drive, dune, nope, and fury are two syllables.
And then I was, someone commented, Lincoln, Halloween, alien, aliens. None of them.
None of them.
Literally
I
none of
I think by that point, people were just thinking, oh, one word.
Halloween one word. Is definitely, I just, aliens is, oh yeah.
Anyway, I
Star
digress.
Star Wars, anyway, Spider-Man.
It was a fun, James and I were just seeing this, we're like, are you seeing this? People don't know what a syllable is.
I, for a second, was like, did we not use the right word? I actually doubted my own
like with the whole antonyms. Is it a true antonym?
Is it a true antonym, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask is the other game we put out was disaster movies. You asked me to
disaster movies.
And we, you know, did that. A couple of people have commented, I want to get your thoughts on this, said Titanic. Do you consider Titanic to be a disaster movie?
Yeah, I'd give it. If you came
really?
Up with it, I'd give it.
I don't think it's that's its primary genre.
For the first 90 minutes, no.
But
it really does give a lot of time to the disaster of the Titanic. I'd accept it in the game.
But I think that...
It's worth discussing.
I think disaster movies are more like genre informed than that. So like...
Yeah.
So the ones I said, like Twister, Towering Inferno, is like, yeah, you've got like Poseidon Adventure. I didn't say that. But like classic, like there's a thing, we must run, people die one by one, and you kind of got to get away from it. And I think things that are borderline are like... Independence Day, like I said, that's almost like a sub-genre of the disaster movie. It's like a crossover between disaster.
Like, where does Armageddon fit into that?
Armageddon is a disaster movie because that is a disaster. But you know what I don't think is a disaster movie is Don't Look Up. Don't Look Up is, yes, it's about a meteor heading towards Earth, but that's a political satire,
it's not a disaster movie.
And I think the same reason Titanic. I think Titanic is a period drama which happens to end with a disaster.
It is quite disaster heavy, though. Like, you know, going in, it's like, this is what's gonna...
But surely, if it was a true disaster movie, the iceberg would hit at the end of Act One, and the rest of the film would be like, how are we going to get off the boat?
But it's a three-hour James Cameron movie.
So basically, you do get 90 minutes
of that. And I still think, it's not like we have 2.5 hours of romance, and at the end, the ship sinks. It's a half and half.
That's what I was going to say.
Bang in the middle. Oh, iceberg hits, bang in the middle. You get a whole movie of beautiful love story, and then you get a whole movie of, we're still love story in there, but like the ship going down. Well, did you see the film Volcano?
No, people were writing that. I've never.
Yeah, I completely forgotten about that film with from Men in Black.
Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones, Volcano.
Did that come out at the same time as Dante's Peak? Is it one of those?
It's sort of early. I think it's like early.
Let me guess. Volcano blows up?
The volcano underneath Los Angeles. You know, like the super San
Andreas
volcano.
Is there a super volcano? I thought it was the San Andreas.
I haven't seen this since it came out. Yeah, sure. There's also Core with Aaron Eckhart.
Aaron, you've been in America too long.
Aaron,
as we say.
Aaron Eckhart.
Yes, I know that film because I saw that on a plane.
There's Danny Tucci in there as well.
Yes, and...
great plane movie, I think.
Well, I mean, it terrified me when I was a kid because there's this sequence, a really stupid sequence. It's so stupid. At the beginning where... So the premise of this film that came out in 2003 is that Earth's core has just stopped working.
Basically. Yeah, it's not like moving.
So, the whole magnetic setup of the world is right. And there's this scene in like London in Trafalgar Square where all these pigeons don't know where to fly. And it's like, because they're ornithologist. They're off. Their compass is off. Yeah. So you've got these scenes of people like, that's because swathes and...
You can imagine the director. All right, everybody just panicking now. Yeah. And action.
And birds are like flying into like a double-decker bus. Then I'm pretty sure a double-decker bus goes over.
Of course it does.
And it's just, I remember like watching this. I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying. Pigeons can do this. And that's a classic disaster movie where people get picked off one by one by one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who plays the female lead in that. I think it might be Mary Thingy from, who was in Weeds. Was it her?
No, I don't know. There's a great moment when he's trying to explain how like the crust and the core works.
Peach.
He's using a peach as an example. He's like, this is the crust and the rest's the thing. And he's like, this is what happens without the magnetic field. And he just gets some deodorant and a match. And, going, and all the people in the boardroom are like,
oh my God.
Thanks for showing
Hillary
us.
Hilary Swank. It's Hilary
also,
Swank.
Also, someone in a meeting just lit some deodorant.
No, I think it's a blowtorch. I think it's blowtorch.
Whatever. Like, you'd be like, what the fuck are you doing? We're in an office, man.
So Aaron Eckhart, Hilary Swank, Stanley Tucci, Bruce Greenwood. Yes, I remember that because there's a bit where it's basically a space movie, but instead of going in space, they're going down.
Yeah.
There's a bit where like a stalactite or one of the pointings falls.
That film's completely
Delroy
rubbish.
Lindo. Oh, there's like, no way. That, yeah. No, I mean, it's completely nuts. Richard Jenkins is in it, apparently. Okay, Alfre Woodard. Yeah, okay. Anyway, that is the core. And that is disaster movies.
I saw this great thing about how when... Michael Bay was shooting.
Oh yeah, I know the Armageddon. Story.
And Affleck was like, because the premise of Armageddon is they got professional drillers, oil drillers, to teach them to become astronauts.
Yeah.
Instead of teaching astronauts to become drillers, where the idea you just drill, you line it up, you drill a hole. Apparently, Ben Affleck asked Michael Bay that question of why not teach astronauts to be drillers. Michael Bay just told him to shut up and fuck off.
Yeah.
It's just like.
And he's like, well, I never asked that question again.
Never mind.
Oh my God. Anyway, welcome back, everyone. This is episode 79 of Pulp Kitchen. We've got a few things to talk about today. We've got two film reviews, two very different films. Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse. Very hard to talk about films that have very similar titles.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say Into
the, but it's Across the.
And also similarly when we had Homecoming, Far From Home, No Way Home.
The next one will be like Beyond the Spider-Verse.
That's exactly what it's called.
Oh.
It's exactly what it's called. You must have already known that.
God, I've not looked at
Into, Across, Beyond. I mean, they're really not trying.
Fine.
Okay. Anyway, we'll talk about those thusly.
Also, some bonus content for you guys this week who are interested. Yes. I'm going to be talking about The Irishman, which I watched on my 7-hour flight to New York.
Good use of plane.
Very good use of plane. I'll get on to why it's a good use of plane because that film's staggeringly long and it's very hard to see. But tune in later in the week for that. We're also going to be talking about spoilers for the finale of Succession season 4 and therefore the whole series. So if you guys are interested, listen to this episode, wait a couple of days. We'll be putting out some bonus content. Very exciting, very fun. Stay tuned for it. But let's move on.
So, James, I have seen the big film out this week, which is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Mm-hmm. I saw it yesterday. I went to see it at the BFI IMAX.
Oh, yeah.
No, and I decided that. Well, it was only £5 more than my local cinema. Mm. And I was like, I might as well just go see
you
that.
You might as well.
And I, obviously, having seen the first one, I was aware how visual it's going to be and how writ large it was. And I thought, I want to see that on the biggest screen possible.
Which is interesting because it's not shot on camera or film or digital. It is it's an animation. So the frame is as large as they choose to make it based on however. So was it a good IMAX experience? Are you happy you did do the IMAX for?
Yes, I was. I would say what I was surprised about in the first 15 minutes, some of the dialogue was a bit quiet, actually. Mm. And I thought, I'm in the IMAX. How can that be possible?
Speakers,
but the film wasn't quiet.
House.
And I've read online that other people are finding that might be a thing. I don't know.
Interesting.
We'll see.
They let Nolan's guy do the sound mixing.
No, it was not muffled. It was just like, yeah, a bit quiet. And I was like, whoa, the levels. Somebody check the levels.
Yeah.
So I saw it yesterday, and James, you haven't seen it, so I'm going to give you my report. I will
Please.
Just say as a caveat, I don't think this actually needs to factor into my review because I don't think it affected my viewing experience, but I did see it with a migraine, which is, you might think that going to see a super visual film in the IMAX for 2.5 hours with a migraine is an idea of hell. But actually, I don't think it affected my experience, but I will just say it in case people are thinking, God, I disagree with George. What happened to him? Maybe that's why.
It's also a film that I haven't seen this one, but based on the last one, it experiments with like old cartoony choppiness as part of its
frame
aesthetic and frame rates. It sort of does like the sort of half 12 frames a second, I'm guessing, and then it sort of switches that. That also adds to a sense of...
So... right, so where to begin? So sequel to Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, a sequel to 2018's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And that's actually 2018, that's 5 years ago. We've had a lot in that time. We've had a pandemic and two other Spider-Man films in that time, Far From Home and No Way Home, right? Okay. In which, you know, we had the whole Peter Parker thing and there was more multiverse. So it's been a while and we return to our characters, but not first to Miles Morales. We have a very good opening 20-minute prologue with Gwen Stacy from, obviously, who was from an alternate timeline, another multiverse. If people just remember, quick recap on the first film. Obviously, you have the whole Spider-Man genesis, one of the origin story via Miles Morales getting bit by a spider. But there's this whole thing, obviously, that being access to the multiverse, meeting alternate Spider-Man and realizing that every single alternate dimension has an alternate version of Spider-Man that has the same things happen to them, you know, the uncle and that kind of thing. So that was kind of invoked, and we met other different Spider-Man. And at the end of that film, everyone went back to their respective multiverses, right? And in this, we begin with Gwen, and she's sort of showing what happened in her life, and she's talking about Miles, and you get this really good opening prologue, I said about 20 minutes, which ends with a kind of invitation to explore the wider multiverse. There are opportunities still to explore it because she encounters Miguel O'Hara, played by Oscar Isaac, who was teased at the end of the first one, who is basically like, yeah, you think you closed it all when you fixed it, but I'm trying to mop up all of these people who are scattered across the wrong multiverses. So when that event happened in the first one, people are now dotted around wrong places and we need to go in and clear it up. And he sort of invites Gwen to take part in that. Then we cut back to Miles Morales. And since the first film, he is now fully Spider-Man. Like, he is just so busy being Spider-Man. He loves it. He's swinging around and he's not actually paying a lot of time and attention to being Miles Morales. So you have this kind of, you know, this parent-teacher meeting about his future and about college, and he's not there. He's trying to deal with an enemy while also trying to get these swinging there. And you have this, I have to say, quite a long first act about him and his relationship with his parents and his identity of... He's feeling a lot of shame and guilt that he can't talk to him about being Spider-Man, but he can't tell him he's missing Gwen and the life and the excitement he had. He's not interested in school, classic kind of stuff. Mm. And then before you know it, Gwen comes back into the fray. And actually I will kind of leave it there because you don't need me to tell you much more other than it is a multiverse exploring fantastical tale that swings forth. So what to say about Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse? I think, I mean, basically, broadly, hugely enjoyed it. I really did. Migraine aside, honestly, I was actually really impressed with it at times. I think what it was is it was always beautiful. Mm. It was often brilliant. It was like refreshingly funny, consistently charming. And you know, I think inherently it's just delightful. It's just a lot of fun. There are moments that are so well visualized and so well captioned, so well imagined, that I genuinely found them a little bit moving. Mm. I think it could have helped the fact that I was seeing it on the biggest screen possible and with the loudest music. But you have, especially in the opening prologue in Gwen's world, with the sweeping visuals and the way it reimagines a scene halfway through and transitions, and paints Gwen's world with these big emotional colors. And there's a bit where she has a conversation with her father that's very conflicted, and he comes into the room and he's kind of slapped in this kind of paint that is heavy and purple pinky hues, and it's very emotive, and it's just so enrapturing and so brilliant. I was really knocked over by it, and there are a couple of action set pieces, all of its action set pieces throughout the film. Yeah. Are nothing short of dazzling and visually just incredible. With the exception that maybe once or twice you might think, there's so much happening. My eyes, for the love of God, my eyes. That's what I really liked about it. I think it's the film is just brimming with imagination. And what it always does is it never takes the easy route. It always thinks of the more clever, interesting, non-pedestrian way to execute an idea. I mean, literally, it's like you have all the pedestrians walking and Spider-Man decides to swing through the streets. That's what this film is. It's like, no, we're going to do everything differently. I think that's really, really brilliant. The conflict I didn't mention in this film is the Spot. It's this kind of vague antagonist who's this character who can kind of open up portholes. Portal holes, sorry, not portholes like in a ship. Portal holes. like portal holes. And it's kind of like a vague villain, but it becomes very important. But the bigger thing about the film is that it's more about identity. And like I said, this whole thing about the first film, he's discovering how to be Spider-Man. And this one, it's like he's forgotten how to be Miles Morales. Mm. And this sort of counter identity.
Also, what makes your Spider-Man different to all the others?
Exactly.
Right? What do you stand for?
And one thing that the film does is it is deeper, it's darker, it's more complex. It really, I think, mostly successfully and bravely, like tackles really knotty, more in-depth ideas. I think the first one is almost like, if it was kind of breezy and childlike, this one is very much more teenagery. It's emo. It's very emo, you know? It's about, yeah, but you know, how can I be this when I want to be that? I will say that I think there are a couple of times, particularly when I said that act one is quite long, where I thought, I really like that you're substantiating the story with more depth and more themes, and I want that to happen. There's nothing about it that I felt was like one-dimensional. But at the same time, by doing that, I kind of missed the free-swinging breeziness of the first one. The first one, you know, would just sail through so great. I mean, I don't know if you thought the same thing, right? The first one,
Completely, yeah. I remember sort of, it didn't come from nowhere into the Spider-Verse, but I think it was very much focused on the other Spider-Man stuff going on. And then that came out and everyone was raving about it.
Yeah.
And then saying, no, it's actually not just a cartoon, which sounds like a reboot that you should really worth seeing. And then discovering its visual style as well as it being great was such a breath of fresh air.
So there was just a few times where I thought, I kind of, with all this heavy kind of discussion about his identity and these themes, I kind of missed the free-spirited, soaring, rapturous highs of the first one. Mm. And I did kind of wonder about younger members of the audience. I mean, I happen to be sat next to like two like pretty young kids who are probably like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I don't know if they're going to follow a lot of this.
Spider-Man does have to do that really, doesn't it? It really does from kids who start watching films upwards. And has to cater.
Anyways, I saw in a classic screening where like there were kids in their Spider-Man outfits and stuff. And I know kids who like and have and can understand and enjoy the first Spider-Verse. I'm talking like age 6. So with this one, I was like, I'm wondering about that. It gets quite plotty and it gets a few times heavy on the canon and the lore of Spider-Man. And it's very much, no, you can't do this because of this and this thing. Oh, and I'm like, girl, there's a lot of discussion. And I'm not saying I just need an action scene thrown in there, but I just kind of,
can we get back to being a little bit of Spider-Man? Maybe it's a minor thing because it's just a hard balance to strike because you want it to also grow as a film. I'd be interested to know if anyone else kind of felt that a few times. What else to say? Yeah, the opening is amazing. The you know, this is on the poster, but there are hundreds of thousands of Spider-Man in this, and that is such a joy. There is, like I said, with the Endeavor Takes the Pedestrian Route, it reminds me of like the best of Pixar, in that any opportunity to do something clever or to do a good joke is used, and it's never like a bad quip. It's always a very intelligent joke that's relevant, and there are so many inventive things it does with the many different types of Spider-Man that is funny. I mean, I laughed a good few times in this film, and that was a joy. I think if you like the first one, you will enjoy this one. There is one caveat, which is about that is not a spoiler. This isn't a spoiler. It's about the way the film concludes and the way it's constructed. But I will just say, if you are someone who is absolutely wanting to see this film with, you know, an absolute no spoiler thing, speed races behind us. If you want to know absolutely nothing, and that's absolutely fine, skip forward two or 5 minutes, just a second before I say this. But I don't think this is a spoiler because I'm happy to tell you haven't seen it. But basically, what I didn't realize until the closing 30 seconds of this film is it's part one. It did a Dune, right?
And now is it a real hard
It's not like a, like I said with Fast 10 a few weeks ago, where it just stops. But it's more that like you get, like I said, in the last minute you go, oh, they're not gonna
finish it.
They're not gonna finish it. This film is 2 hours and 16. I did start to feel like, oh, there's a lot. Although I felt the film was long, and I was kind of ready for it to wrap up, I still wanted a resolution, and it didn't quite give me that. I think that in a way, I honestly think people would have preferred to watch a 3-hour version of this film than for it to cut the fifth act, very big climactic event, and use that as the opening event for the next film in 2 years' time.
Yeah.
And we have an email, which I'll read out in a second, who kind of thought, they described it as being June.
Do you think it's better when these films, before you go and see it, tell you it's a part one? Do you think that preps you more for that versus when you just think you're seeing the second Spider-Man film and then you get to the end and you're like, oh.
Well, that's it. I personally think it's better to know going in.
I think
because
so.
I felt a little bit cheated, and there was this feeling, I could feel it in the audience afterwards, of like bewildered excitement. You know, kind of like people are like, oh, well, we enjoyed that, but it's just sort of, lights up, curtain down, show's over.
It's also not shocking or new. Every comic book film that's out has a sequel that it's prepping for. So it's not like, oh my God, they're going to do
it. I knew it was doing Beyond the Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
I just thought we were going to wrap up and conclude this. And I feel like it's a very TV thing to do. And it's one thing when you're going to tune in next week for Doctor Who to keep you plugged in. But for something that's 2 years away, I kind of feel a little bit cheated. Mm. Not that it doesn't end in an interesting place. It does end in a kind of interesting situation.
And there's another sort
situation.
Of like, sort of turned around by the end. You feel
and it also, in retrospect, it does kind of make sense now why there's so much plot and exposition front-loaded.
Yeah.
Because they're really trying to build and establish the mythos, the canon, the rules of this multiverse. And I anticipate that the second one will be able to do a lot more because we've set that up so much. But I kind of think, oh, I see why that was so wordy, because you were building it as a part one. But actually, like I said, I almost would have preferred I think most people would have almost preferred make it longer, but make it have a resolution than making it a 5-hour movie split over 2 years.
Fine. I mean, it's apart from that, I'm really glad to hear that it is good. I was slightly worried that from when Multiverse 1 came out, we weren't inundated with the multiverse.
Spider-Verse.
And now the second one's come out midway through the multiverse of everything. Even the non-comic book films are having multiverses. And I was wondering, would this whole sense of what they're bringing these, they're all in the same world, that novelty would sort of be really lost on me.
Well, but two things.
I'm glad to hear it's still good.
I think there was a moment, there were a couple of times where even though I was enjoying it, I was like, the first one was such a well executed, concise piece of work
that I almost didn't want them to do a sequel to it. I really kind of wish they. I mean, it's Spider-Man and it's Sony. I mean, who?
I was happy for them to wait 5 years. I'm like, I know these things take years to make. I'm quite happy to rest.
But to answer your question about whether you'll be exhausted, I would say, well, no, because truly, I think this is the best medium with which to render Spider-Man. Because yes, as great as it was to see Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield with Tom Holland, how can that compete with spoilers for the film that came out 2 years ago?
You're in a film podcast listening to Spider-Man content.
But that doesn't compare to there being hundreds and hundreds of different individual Spider-Men designed and drawn around there. And that even the spectacle and the action is much more exciting than any of the live action films could ever compare to.
Yes, yeah.
Because in the live action ones, you have to deal with
it's liberated by not being live
action.
Totally.
It doesn't have to obey the rules of, and it's, and that's
I'm so much more happier for an animation to do that than Doctor Strange 2 to try and do that.
I know.
It works so much better, isn't it?
And I know it's clearly something they're thinking about, because I know that later this year, we've also got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where they've clearly gone, you know what? These are inherent, like, cartoonish
things. Let's go back and just
do that properly. So that was Spider-Man Across the Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Let us know your thoughts. I would be interested to know if people felt similar to me. I'm seeing rapturous reviews online. Did anyone disagree? Did anyone love it? Did anyone really not like it?
Well, Ellie, ahead of the game, has written in and says, hi.
Sorry, this is the email I was referring to about the ending.
Ellie writes in and says, hi, hope you're both well. Big fan of the podcast, first time emailing in. Might be a question to use in a spoiler bonus episode. You bring a bit of calm to my week, as when I listen to your podcast, I feel like I'm sitting with a couple of friends talking film and TV.
You are,
as my bread and butter is good popcorn movies. You both make me feel very cultured.
Hey, Ellie, you are among friends.
This is what we plan to do. Sorry it's a bit rambling. Well, to get to my question, I've just come out of my first local screening I could get for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Fantastic, by the way, if slightly too jam-packed. The one thing that did annoy me was the ending. I felt as though I had been Dune Part 1'd.
Yes.
And felt the film could have kept going, but it just cut to black with a third still to play out. Yeah. I feel as though this is the new trendy thing for big franchises to do. Have either of you seen the movie yet? If so, what did you think? Do you get annoyed with endings like that, or do you just accept it personally? Personally, I was going to just go and have a word with the projectionist to put the rest of the movie on. Thanks for the hard work. Ellie from Birmingham.
Thank you, Ellie from Birmingham. I do think it's annoying. That's the thing, frankly, isn't it? Yeah. I love the film. Like, we all enjoy the film enough for it to be like, that's fine. But like, I do think it's a bit of a cop out. I do think it's cynical. And there are, this is being very cynical now. I mean, obviously, I think it's a cynical move to obviously get people back in a couple of years' time. But even that, there are more references. I'm not going to say what they are. There are more references in this film to the live action Spider-Man than the first film. And I can't help but thinking that was a slightly cynical move from someone upstairs at Sony who said, hey, we got all these other the Spider-Man stuff. Would you mind just, you know, maybe throwing in a reference to this and doing something with that just to make people feel great about the whole Spider-Verse?
Just on, like, you know, part ones and cutting stories off, there's been moments where, like, I feel like you and I, when we saw Dune, we thought, wow, what an incredible presentation and so many great things to pick on, but half a story. I only feel like I've had half the meal, and it's really hard to give like a really complete opinion on it until we've seen the second. This has happened a few times where I think it was like Deathly Hallows part one, which is really, like, you know,
or Hobbit part two.
I remember with Deathly Hallows, it's like, I know this is part one, they're splitting it, make loads of money, blah, blah. I remember leaving the cinema just feeling a bunch of nothing. I didn't dislike the film, but I wasn't like, oh, this is so great. It took me waiting for part two to come out, and then years later, re-watching them all to fully appreciate what part one did, and then being able to just immediately going into Deathly Hallows part two.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of is, when you're lost and you've only got half the puzzle, it's like, give an opinion on something that's incomplete. And you're like, well, it's quite hard. And I have to wait a year or however many to like get the next
bit. I do also think it has an effect. If you don't give an audience even an attempt at a proper resolution, you affect their emotional relationship and their emotional connection to that film. Because I honestly believe it's the way the brain processes a story.
Yeah.
And it cannot complete the data file it's a corrupt data file. Yeah. You have not given them a proper resolution. Mm. So it's stored in a different way.
It's weird how we like that.
It's not stored in a proper way that you feel, because you can't feel anything about it because it hasn't had an emotional conclusion. Mm. So you're kind of left and it's more like an objective, oh, I saw that. Yes, I went to a screen and I saw that, and I'll see how I feel in a few years' time. But I would have liked to have finished Across the Spider-Verse feeling, I really enjoyed, a complete film. Can't wait to watch the next one.
Yeah.
Like they used to do.
Mm. Just completely separately, but something. You know, I'm quite nosy about what people watch on their on planes. I like
to
look. I saw a little girl about, must have been 7, 8 years old on an iPad watching Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man 1. Oh. And I got quite a nice fuzzy feeling about that they're the oldest films in the world. But like, yes, that someone who has probably discovered Spider-Man from the recent films.
Sure.
I don't know if it's the first time watching it or if she's just watched it. I'm like, yeah, she's going back. Yeah. And like at the age I was when I watched. Oh. And I just thought it was a really heartwarming thing. Spider-Man is for everyone. But guys, yeah, as George said earlier, right into hell.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
At popkitchenpodcast.com, we would love to hear your thoughts on Spider-Man across the Spider-Verse. Yeah. So, George, another film that we've had a chance to see that's out this week is Reality, which is a film that is on, it's an HBO product coming out on their service called Max, the rebranded
in the States,
Max,
yeah.
In the States.
It's got a cinema release here.
And just, you know, it's quite an interesting film. It's 80 minutes long, and just straight coming out of it, did you know what this film was about?
No, I knew nothing about what it was about. I'd seen the poster, which was Sidney Sweeney's face, and it says Reality, and I honestly thought science fiction.
Yeah,
Reality. It does slightly distorted
across
look.
That I was like, oh, okay. A little bit. And I think, you know, I knew coming out of this, I obviously knew the story that it touches on, but I didn't know the person behind it and how that all came together. And I think coming out of that film, I think we agree, I don't really want to spoil that for people who haven't seen it. So we are going to sort of be talking very delicately about it and what it tries to do, but we're not going to reveal sort of how this film sort of unfolds and what it has to say about, you know, whistleblowers and people who reveal stuff to the people. And I think there's an interesting conversation to have about that.
Yeah.
But what we essentially have with Reality is, it is an American drama film directed by Tina Slatter, and it is based on a true story. And what we have in the opening is a real interrogation transcript from actual dialogue that happened in an FBI interrogation.
Yeah, an FBI audio recorder.
Audio recorder. So the FBI basically have audio recorders, and what we are seeing is a dramatized version of everything that was said. Yeah. And
everything is verbatim. That's the key. That it's
verbatim. And I think at one point it plays real audio and then very quickly mixes in the audio.
But every single word and everything is verbatim with what was said in the transcripts.
And so we meet Reality Winner, played by Sidney Sweeney, who I think is very much sort of, she's been such a huge star coming off of White Lotus and also Euphoria, and I think this really has sort of taken her away from potentially being typecast as a disaffected teen. I don't think she is, but sort of graduating from that. We have Sidney Sweeney playing Reality Winner, who is in her car coming back from grocery shop when she gets a knock on her window.
And we should say at this point, we've just seen her at work, in a very nondescript work.
Really just office cubicle. In a cubicle with television screens on, really just set the basest of settings of who she is, which they come back to. And you just get a very polite knock on the window, and it's revealed to be an FBI agent, and they're asking her to come out of the car, and they need to speak to her. And what plays out essentially is almost in real time, actually, you could say, a very sort of polite and by the books play by play of what happens when the FBI in civilian clothing approach someone in a domestic neighborhood setting, needing to tell them that they have a warrant to search them, their car, and their house, and how they sort of navigate the awkward uncomfortableness of neither party knows why each person is here and what potential situation could occur. And it sort of unfolds this mystery of why is this seemingly normal person being given like what looks like the highest treatment of security from the FBI?
Yeah.
What information do the FBI need to get from Reality Winner? And why has this all happened in the first place?
Yeah.
I'm a little bit apprehensive to reveal more than that.
That's good enough, yeah.
And you know, we talked about it feeling like science fiction. It also felt like something always sort of tricks you into thinking it's something so much darker than it actually is, so much more sinister. There's this sort of like overly polite, by the numbers textbook dialogue. And I thought it was really interesting. But George, I'm sorry, someone else.
That's the FBI.
But George, just Reality. How did you get on with it?
So like you, I went in not knowing anything about the story. and having a complete miss. But obviously, I knew just before I watched it, essentially, the kind of vague what it was going to be. But like I said, prior to that, no idea. Yeah, I was really, really impressed by Reality. I think it's a really interesting film.
Yeah.
I think that what you have is a very gripping story. At a basic level, it's a very gripping story.
Yeah.
And I watched it with...
That's all to do with how it presents itself, because on paper it almost
is. Well, exactly.
Is,
yeah. I should say it's based off a play. It's based off a play. And what I think is brilliant about it is that, although when I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, this could be a play, I never thought this was stagey.
No.
It's not like when we watch The Whale, when you're like, oh, this is just a play.
Yeah.
This is a play being filmed. This is based off a play, I believe it was called Is This a Room? I never felt that this was staged, but it is clear it has good bones dramatically. The whole situation has good bones. So what I found when I watched it with my girlfriend and my flatmate is we were immediately leaning in. You could feel, you know, you could just feel people transfixed and watch. And that was, we remained like that for the entire 83-minute runtime, which I think is really great. It's the kind of film that you and I like.
Yeah,
83 short.
It's the kind of storytelling I wish we had way more of.
Concise and to the point. And I was actually amazed at how
a focus on like performance, relationship versus just like the biggest idea we can think of.
Exactly.
Right? How do you take an idea?
How do you a concept and this obviously takes place just in her yard and her house.
Yeah.
And I was I was amazed at how well a verbatim transcript serves a dramatic telling.
Yeah.
Because your risk with verbatim theatre, obviously originally, but verbatim in this, is that you can sometimes, it can be mundane and it can sort of chafe at the restriction of reality, no pun intended, reality placed upon it. Whereas obviously you're lacking the dramatic license to go and explore that in a different way. Mm. But what the transcript is in itself very tense and very gripping. And I was really impressed by that. I think what the film... It's successful after being a very serviceable, gripping thriller, is also the fact that we are accustomed in seeing in films the FBI interrogations to be sort of highly dramatized in a very sort of glossy, you know, sterile lit room. We think we know, and we've seen it countless times in a very sort of genre setting. But what I think is amazing, what you were kind of saying there, what is fascinating is how... is how a procedure is operated.
Yeah.
How an FBI
procedure
is operated.
To be done.
You have this great double-hander with the two FBI agents who are sort of leading the conversation with Reality. One played by Josh Hamilton and the other played by Marshawn Davis. And Josh Hamilton's an actor who turns up in lots of stuff who I quite like. He kind of came up in the 90s with the likes of Billy Crudup and Ethan Hawke, and he was the lead in like Kicking and Screaming, and he's in a lot of No Bound Back stuff. But he's also in Manchester by the Sea. He's the lawyer who has to tell Casey Affleck that, you know, Jerry wanted you to be the guardian. And he's also the dad in Eighth Grade. And he presents this fantastic, mild-mannered, you know, swept over hair, glasses, looking like an IT consultant. Shirt tucked in.
Almost a Walter White before.
Basically, flip pad notebook. But contrasted with Marshawn Davis, who is big, muscular, imposing, and looking at her in a kind of different way. And what I find interesting is that, yes, you have the transcript of what is written, but then the creative license comes in with the blocking.
I was just going to say, the blocking was so perfect.
So interesting.
Time.
When you really get to the nitty gritty, when you really get to the essential conversation at the heart of this transcript, you have, Josh Hamilton placed in the foreground and Marshall Davis in the side, then moved. And I could just see the drama at work, and I really liked it.
There's also this sense that they are aware of the fact that they are two men approaching a woman on her own in her property, asking to walk in the door.
Yeah.
So obviously they are completely sensitive and by the book for that. But then there are so many times that they realize the fact that they are two men has an advantage over how this person could potentially move or run. Like there's this moment when they get her phone and they're like, how do you unlock it? And she goes to reach to help. Yeah. She's like, no, don't touch it.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah.
It's almost like peak, like anxiety of a Russian spy could quickly like flip the sim, like all of that stuff. And you're like, oh my God, like you're not allowed to let someone touch a phone.
Feels such conflict, which is great drama. And
how confused is she versus how confused should she be?
Yeah. And like their conversation at times runs that really uncomfortable line, which it's almost like threateningly polite.
Yeah.
But not aggressive, but no, it's just a below aggressive.
I can ask what you want to do, but I can do whatever I want.
And then there are things you're like, is that a tactic or is that a genuine question? So when Josh Hamilton really starts to try and talk to her,
he's, like I said, very benign, gets his notepad out. He says, oh, excuse me, I've got to make notes. And then it's like, do you want water? Do you want water? Yeah, we can get you water. If you want to sit at any time, like, I'd be happy to sit.
Yeah, okay. I'd be happy to sit.
But we all sit. If you want to sit, just sit. And it's just this kind of bewilderment. And you're like, is this a deliberate tactic? And it's really fascinating. And also taking place in a very, very banal setting.
Yeah.
This very basic home.
Condo even.
Faceless, middle America. It's in what's the name? Alexandria, Georgia? Something like that.
I don't know.
Forgive me. I know it's not faces, but it is, you know, generic Midwest. And you have this very, very interesting film. Yeah, Sydney Sweeney, great.
It's fantastic.
It's great to break away from being a bratish teen. Not that she's bad in this role.
No,
great,
yeah.
But like, really gives us something. And then I also, it's very informative because I was like, oh, with where the film goes.
Yes.
I was like, oh, I see. I was aware that but I wasn't aware of that in my ignorance. I now connect it together, and I think it's a really, like, it's just a solid, good watch. It's one of those things we always talk about with like a good 90-ish minute film, tightly paced, tightly created. There's no fat on it at all. There's no excess because it sticks to the truth, the true drama at the heart of it. And I agree. I love the idea. Or very aware of that kind of wider idea of these men invading this woman's personal space and invading the home and invading. You could almost read it separately as like a home invasion thriller, but very slow home invasion, where it's like they move gradually from the garden into the house.
I think part of its genius for me was, you know, the point it, sirens on our end, the point it makes in the end of the film, and it, whatever you want to deduce from it politically or how that frames that period of time and the thing that was done and the person involved, it does such a good job of letting you fill all that in as the credits roll.
I was just gonna say, in case we just hadn't said, this is obviously we said it was a real thing that happened, but it happened in June 2017.
Yeah, that's the time period it's in. And it really sort of goes, okay, here is a scenario, a very ordinary scenario that really happened to a seemingly ordinary person with very ordinary protocols. And then like at the end, it goes, this is what this means. Yeah. And now I can go, oh, instead of like spoon feeding me politics and cutting away to government or cutting away to another, or giving me loads of flashbacks I don't need, it just let me fill in everything. And now I know exactly how to feel about it. And I think that is just a brilliant piece of storytelling because it let me figure that out myself. And I go, wow, the implications of the story that it's told are very, very fascinating and are worthy of a discussion beyond the film. Yeah. The film didn't do all the discussion for me, which I really, really liked.
And it is the kind of film you finish and you think, I want to talk about it with the people I've seen it and we wanted to engage in it. I agree, there was a point.
And it's a story you do know. Like you will know part of the story once it's revealed to you. You'll be like, oh, of course.
And I think that I just felt once I realized that the film was really working for me, I was like, this is really interesting. I've not seen something like this. I haven't seen something that is so inherently dramatic, almost theatrical without being stage-like, you know, or stagey. Yeah,
format-wise, it almost sort of lends itself to TV whilst being very cinematic and worthy of cinema. Like it's a product of a streaming service. Mm. There's also a really great moment where obviously it starts with the two of them knocking on the window, very politely asking, and you know, we do have a warrant. And then when you know, sort of the situation is she's not fleeing or violent, and they call it in, and then like six black. The huge Chryslers swarm in, and then you're like, oh my God, these are the stakes. Like, it's all seemingly very... Yeah. And all the FBI are kind of in civilian clothing, because I'm thinking, you can't just turn up in a neighborhood but with armed SWAT. Like, you'll start a riot.
And one of them is so, like, stereotypically dressed in the wraparounds. The Oakley wraparounds with, like, a white nylon... yellow nylon shirt stretched over a big gut. And there's that bit at the beginning where... They've spoken to her and she goes to reach for she turns towards her car, walks towards it to get something from the back seat, and an SUV just pulls up to stop that car from leaving.
Yes.
Just in case she was going to jump in the car, and it's like there immediately.
You just realise this operation has been thought out. Yeah. We also didn't mention the fact that within the film are redacted pieces, and it almost like there are certain parts where it cuts to a white sheet of like FBI documented briefing, and it will show you the script as it's being spoken sometimes, and then it will go black, like, you know, like 50 spy redacted. And what happens is the characters almost glitch out of the scene and sort of go mute, or they disappear, and it sort of glitches in this sort of Spider-Verse
way. Yeah, in a way, yeah.
And you're like, oh, why is that? And it really adds the tension and the mystery, which I thought was really interesting.
Also, I think that, I mean, not to draw it to a close on like a pun, but like obviously the film's called Reality, but I do think it's that idea as well. When you're in that situation being like, okay, is this real? Is this happening?
Yeah.
Is this?
Again, like everything is trying to, we've all been trained to think that something much more sinister or dark is potentially going on.
And also, you
sit with it.
The way that the film goes, it can also be called truth as well. It's like, truth, reality. So,
and it plays on the fact that, you know, when you are, it's like when you go through immigration at the US and they ask you about every question, where are you staying and who are you and how long you've been here, you just inherently feel guilty.
Yeah.
And it really plays on that feeling. If you ask anyone enough questions, chances are they've done something wrong and they're going to feel guilty.
So, as you can tell, we really enjoyed it and we were really enthused by it. If you do get a chance to catch it, like I said, it's not a long film, really worth catching. That's Reality.
I'd be happy to talk about what the film actually was about maybe in a couple of weeks if people send in their thoughts. I think I'd be quite comfortable to talk about the actual subject of the film and what it addresses. I think that'd be really interesting to have that conversation.
And as ever, you send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Hello, welcome to the email section of the show where we read out your emails. We should just say, guys, we have a lot of emails. We have a bit of a backlog because James has been away and stuff, but we will get through them. We will read them out. If there's a bit of a delay reading them out, don't worry, we'll get there. They're not going anywhere. They're right here. We will get to them. It just might take a bit of time, and we want to give everyone their fair amount of time.
And I also think we're going to try and prioritise people sending their thoughts on the films that are out right now.
Exactly.
I think it's always quite nice for us to review a film the week before, come back, you guys have seen it, we get to hear about what you guys think, we reflect again on it. I think if you've got an email to send about a film that's out, it'd probably get front-loaded.
Yeah.
Speaking of, Aidan writes into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Hi, Aidan.
Says, Dear James and George, Dear,
I like that. Formal.
It's not just like, hi.
No, dear.
Dear.
He sat down to write this. I can see him at his desk.
Quill.
Bureau.
Calligraphy. Yeah. Dear James and George, I hope this email finds you well. I wanted to follow up on James's review of Bo is Afraid and express my agreement with his sentiments. Guys, last week I reviewed Bo is Afraid. Please go and check that out if you haven't seen it already. I had the privilege of attending an early screening of the film and have eagerly awaited your thoughts before sharing my own. James, your review perfectly captures the essence of Bo is Afraid. It is a truly remarkable cinematic experience that pushes the boundaries of storytelling. The film's ability to blend elements of humour, absurdity and introspection is nothing short of extraordinary. I definitely found myself captivated for the first hour and 30 minutes, immersed in its twisted and thought-provoking narrative. I completely agree that the film got a bit tiring towards the end, but I felt like the way the credits rolled at the end left me in perfect circumstances to reflect on everything that was just blaring into my eyeballs for the last 3 hours. I won't delve into specific details to avoid spoiling the experience for George, but I can confidently say that Bo is Afraid will leave an indelible mark on both of you. It's a film that defies convention and demands contemplation, offering a unique and unforgettable journey into the depths of the human psyche.
Wow.
George, I eagerly look forward to hearing your thoughts after you've had the chance to watch Bo is Afraid. Keep up the fantastic work. Kind regards, Aidan, sent from my iPhone. Yeah, it is this thing about it will leave an imprint on you.
Well, that's good. That's what you want from a film, isn't it? You want to have a reaction.
But Ari Aster in particular, it's like, stamp, you see my film, here you go, it's in your brain for better or worse. And it is really like that. A lot of the people who've written in have said they have enjoyed it. I wouldn't have been surprised if people said they got really tired by it.
I don't know, James, if I can see it at the cinema.
I know, it's staggeringly long. Chloe, do you want me to read this other one?
Not because I don't want to, but I just don't think it's plausible with the time we have and how long the film has been out.
So. Yeah, which is a shame. But do you want to read the next one or should
you do it, because you read it.
Chloe also writes in, Rebo is Afraid, and says, Hi, James and George. First time emailer. Hope you're both well.
Oh, thank you.
I discovered you about 3 months ago, and I'm now completely obsessed with your podcast.
Get in.
I, like many others, am now going back to listen to every episode, only stopping to listen to the latest released before jumping back into your back catalog.
Kind of like an in-media res thing, like a Tarantino.
You're going in, there's a new one.
Yeah.
Now I'm going back. I like that. Falling back in love with cinema because of you guys, blah, blah, blah. She writes blah, blah, blah.
I was going to say, James.
She wrote blah, blah, blah. It's kind of like a compliment, but like, all right, enough.
No, I love it.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to jump in and say that I really enjoyed hearing James's thoughts on Beau is Afraid. The way you described it is both fascinating but completely exhausting, really hit the nail on the head. I too feel that towards the end, it felt like listening in on a family member's therapy session, wishing you could unhear slash see the most intimate thoughts in their mind. The film really does test you, but equally leaves you with so much to think about that ultimately it's an ordeal that's amazing to experience. As an ordeal that's amazing to experience.
An ordeal is never a positive thing.
No. The more I sat with it, the more I appreciated how brilliant it was. I found myself roaring with laughter in the first half, but losing comedic steam towards the end. I felt the same. The question, and then Chloe has a separate question about anamorphic. Should we just go straight into it? The question I wanted to ask is, what is anamorphic or an anamorphic look? You mentioned it a few times in your reviews of Women Talking and Rye Lane. I did do some brief Googling and got a rough idea, but then got confused and gave up and thought I would just ask you guys. I assume you have a better idea than me because you've mentioned it a few times. I never assume because I say something I know what I'm talking about. This is a bad assumption. I would love to know what effect this is and how you know something is anamorphic when you're watching it. Thank you for making this such a great show every week. I was shocked to realize you are fully independent and not being produced by some mega production company. Oops. I wish I could say I was your most remote listener, emailing you from an iceberg in Antarctica. Alas, I listen whilst pretending to work in my uni library in Manchester.
Nice.
All the best. Get in. Chloe.
It is, we are independently produced, yes. And you can tell by the bags under our eyes.
The fatigue, the weariness of needing to go through this and bring it out. Anamorphic, I think, I did mention it in Women Talking and Rye Lane, which are definite anamorphic films. So you have, how should I explain this? So we have two different types of camera lenses. I'm being very sort of broad strokes. Yeah. You've got spherical lenses, which are like the ones you've got here, like photography lenses, yeah, or traditional film lenses. And then you've got anamorphic lenses, which are very big, very expensive. So imagine you've got a film stock or a digital camera sensor.
Yes.
And usually when we watch films, we have like a letterbox style where we have it
black
sort
bars
of black and, bars, yeah, which sort of matches the perspective of the eyes and it's more cinematic. If you want to create a wider field of view without cropping your image, losing resolution, yeah, or taking something away from your film reel, you shoot in something that's called an anamorphic lens. And an anamorphic lens essentially compresses your image. So when you see anamorphic shots come out, they're all sort of long and stretched,
yeah,
which in post are then stretched out again. And the effect is being able to create a wider field of view without losing compression that a lens gives you.
So it's not like... it's not to be confused with like Panavision and like,
no.
So it's not.
It's like the effect of the glass morphs the perspective of the camera.
So it's about depth of field.
Allows it to be stretched out. Not necessarily. It does have an effect on depth of field. Maybe I'm doing a butchered job. It's kind of like it makes everything look very cinematic. And it's like you don't have to lose any resolution. You just get to stretch it out.
And you predominantly see that with film stock as opposed to digital.
The rules, which are obviously made to be broken, is that spherical lenses typically present the world how it is. So if you want to make something look quite realistic and quite normal, yes, you don't want to give it too much license, you'll shoot with a spherical lens.
Got it.
When you shoot anamorphic, you are typically trying to make something look otherworldly and fantastical and cinematic. And
does Nolan shoot anamorphic?
Yes, when he's not shooting IMAX, he shoots anamorphic. So J.J. Abrams shoots The Force Awakens in anamorphic. Michael Bay will shoot Transformers in anamorphic. It makes everything look epic.
You
want to see the Millennium Falcon. It makes a wider... It makes your landscape look bigger than it is.
Okay.
And then, I mean, obviously, like, rules are made to be broken.
So it is a deliberately exaggerated, distorted way of presenting worlds in a very cinematic way.
So, but then again, like, so Uncut Gems is shot anamorphic, but that's a really grounded and real situation.
But it's using the anamorphic setting to really heighten
his
and
environment,
drama.
And everything looks cinematic, but it's very confined. So, like, yes, those are the rules. I could say anamorphic looks more cinematic, but it's how you treat that effect.
I get it.
Specifically with Women Talking, that has a really great use of anamorphic, which I said, because it expands its area. So it gives you more real estate without making your lens wider.
Got it.
And it's really careful and intricate about how it blocks people in the scene. And I think that works really well for Women Talking as a piece that takes place inside a barn.
Fantastic.
I might have butchered that, but that's roughly what you do.
For us laymans.
Yeah, it like really big films, fun, you shoot anamorphic, like the Batman. Recently,
yeah, obviously,
all amazing.
When you say that, they make sense.
Yeah, That's what you do. It just makes stuff cool and cinematic.
Thank you, James, for the question.
Should we get on to some other emails?
Let's do it. Also, I apologize. I have got a bit of a cold, everyone, and I sound a little bit nasally. So my apologies. This email is from Christopher, who says, "Hi, guys. I want to start off by saying thank you. I found your podcast last year, shortly before I left the cave. Left the UK for Australia.
Cave. I'm a wolf, man.
I want to say, I found your podcast last year, shortly before I left the UK for Australia. Since then, I have made my way through all of your episodes, many of which have kept me company on the various long drives and flights across the country.
Nice.
It's great to hear people talk about film and TV with the same level of passion as your own, and it also feels like a comforting slice of home.
This is why I say sirens and RN, because people are driving.
Yes,
people are driving.
I'm also thinking, Chris, that's just a lovely, lovely thing to say. Thank you so much. My question is, are there any films that you are somewhat reluctant to watch again due to a worry that they will not live up to the experience you had when you first watched them? Now, this is an interesting question because we've had what films which are like you wouldn't want to watch again because they're so like horrific and impressive. But this is like the experience. You don't want to dispel the myth of the experience. Mm. Chris says, for instance, I saw Gaspar Noé's Climax. Have you seen Climax?
No.
Oh, yeah, I have. For instance, I saw Gaspar Noé's Climax as the closing film of the 2018 Fright Fest Film Festival in Odeon's Leicester Square Cinema. Just think of Climax. Yeah. A lot of people might have seen it, but for those who haven't, Gaspar Noé, who's a very sort of like outre provocative filmmaker anyway, Climax is about a dance... a dance troupe, a dance studio of dance students in, I think, the 90s. And it begins with this, like, shot of this static 90s TV, and it's all their, like, audition interviews. And then it cuts to their, like, their big dance performance, the big thing they're doing in a, like, retreat in, like, the Alps. Okay, I might be paraphrasing, might be getting some of this wrong, but essentially a snowy... you know, retreat, and it's this isolated studio where they're doing their final dance routine. It's just the dancers there's no audience. And basically what happens is you have this fantastically shot dance number, which is probably shot on anamorphic, James.
Right, yeah.
And someone, we don't know who, but somehow the punch gets spiked with LSD. And what happens next in this, James, 90-minute movie, what happens next is... just crazy. You have almost endless long takes. It's one of those things that I think it's almost shot in unbroken takes. There are breaks in it, but like it's got that long continuing sense of madness and hysteria. And it's one of those films that like, if you're not in 20 minutes in, you're not going to be in for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
You've got to buckle up and just enjoy the carnival that's about to happen. It's crazy. Nice. Anyway, I digress. Back to Chris's email. So anticipation had been building for Gaspar Noé's Q&A before the screening, as well as the festival organisers assuring us that this would be something special to see on Odeon's huge screen. We like the Odeon Leicester Square. I think that's a good screen. I think we've seen a couple of premieres there.
Yeah, we have.
Boy, were they right. For 96 minutes, I was transfixed by the booming EDM music, dance numbers, and experimental filmmaking as the hallucinogenic nightmare became increasingly more unhinged. I left the screening feeling drained. Excuse me, I'm so blocked up. Feeling drained, but having loved it. Since then, I have never felt compelled to revisit it, as I don't think I could possibly have the same impact again. The heightened setting, the build-up, the enormous screen, sharing the experience of the crowded cinema of people loving it as much as you, all of this undoubtedly had a big part to play in how much I viewed and processed the film. Something I don't want to potentially tarnish through seeing it again with a completely different mindset. It was the perfect way to see that film, and maybe that's enough. Have you had similar experiences? Keep up the good work. I hope you'll continue to keep me company for the remainder of my travels and beyond. All the best, Chris. Chris, thank you. I do have an answer for that. First of all, what I will just say is, if you're worried about... because you obviously sometimes you want to rewatch a film because you want to dig into it again, but you're worried about dispelling the experience. I would just say, leave it for as long as possible. The longer you leave it, the more you will move into different parts of your life and different periods of your life, and you'll age, and therefore you will be able to approach the film differently. And it won't be just repeating a memory of something that happened recently. You'll actually be able to see it with fairly new eyes. Mm. So even if you don't enjoy it as much, you will be able to derive something different from it, whether good or bad. For me, I do have an experience like that. In 2015, I think I might have talked about this before, probably, who knows. But in 2015, I went to see Stop Making Sense at the Duke of York Theatre in Brighton. And
Stop Making Sense is regarded as one of the best concept films ever made. And it was made filmed by Jonathan Demme, who did Silence of the Lambs in Philadelphia. And it's a Talking Heads concert shot in a way that is so cinematic and brilliantly done. You know, there are loads of cinematic decisions in it, but like, they don't show the audience until at the very end. So you're very much locked in. Mm. The whole set design is interesting. Like, it begins with just David Byrne playing guitar, and then they build the set around him. And it's just fucking great music as well. It's just a great, great time. And we saw it, I saw it with two friends who equally like Talking Heads as much as me. And we saw it on this big screen. And what I loved is that by the fifth track, which was Burning Down the House, these like half the screening room in front of us just got up and were dancing in the aisles. And at first we're like, oh my God, can we do that? This is a cinema. This is meant to be a film. And before you know it, we were just like, oh my God, we're going to do it. And we spend the entirety of the remainder of the film in the aisles dancing with all these other people. And it was like being at a gig. And I was up and it was like watching this Talking Heads gig live. And what was crazy is I turned around and like half the screening room was still sat watching this film. And I was oh my God, these poor bastards are trying to watch this film normally. And they've got us dancing, but I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Yeah.
It was so great. And they're re-releasing Stop Making Sense this year.
Oh, amazing.
And I'd love to see it. I'd love it if they put it on in something like the IMAX. But do I want to watch it sat down? I really want to watch it sat down? Can it really beat that experience of being able to dance and sing along as if you're there? I don't know. I don't know if sitting down watching it is as great.
Interesting.
So that's my answer.
I love that. This next one is from Trevor, who says, my dude.
Yeah, Trevor from LA, who we've been referencing a few times. And like, we got to you, Trevor.
Thinking Trevor is like, dude, like, oh my. The turtle from Finding Nemo, yeah.
Man, come to LA.
He's listening in Haley's voice.
Yeah, that's my name.
Of course, I still listen to your show, dude. I'm listening.
The last thing about, it was like Trevor had wrote in about Guardians of the Galaxy, but before that, someone had written in and asked us what had happened to Trevor's story about the guy who had never seen a film before.
Thing. We
and Trevor has
it.
Finally replied, and
he had since sent an email, but now through this slow churning of in the emails and podcasts. Here we are. Trevor says, my dudes, of course I still listen to your show. I've been listening since the days when you made food to go with the movie talk. I listen regularly, but haven't sent any emails because life has been busy. That's
course.
Okay.
Thank you, Trevor.
And you have a lot of fans who love to chat with you, and I don't want to bother. Oh, Trevor, how considerate.
Never bother.
I do comment on your TikTok all the time, though. Haha.
Nice.
I was absolutely thrilled to hear my name come up on your show this week. It's such a thrill just to know that you guys remember me, but I'm absolutely chuffed to bits to use your parlance.
That is, to use our parlance.
Yeah. That another listener remembers my story from over a year ago.
It's one of the great halls of fame of Pulp Kitchen
go
Tales.
Go and seek out that episode. I don't know which episode it is.
I think that's like an episode 30.
30 something.
No, 13. Oh,
13, do you think?
I'm pretty sure it's early. I think it's early last year.
Oh, it's great.
Great story.
We basically dissected what, if you're going to see your first film as a grown adult and you've not seen a film, what film do you watch?
Fascinating.
I think we gave it like half an hour. It's fantastic. I'm truly honored that people enjoyed that story and it sticks with them. The funniest thing is I actually sent you an email on Monday the 15th before this week's show came out because I wanted to chime in on Guardians of the Galaxy. Not sure when you record your episodes. So what a crazy coincidence. I came up organically. Yes, crazy coincidence. To answer the listeners' questions about what happened with that friend who had never seen a movie, I'm afraid I don't have an update. Oh. That story actually happened back in 2019. He was a friend of my then girlfriend. Not so, sadly, she and I split up during the pandemic. And so naturally
peripheral... Trevor say, not so sadly, we split up.
Yeah, you put brackets, not so. Sadly, she and I split up during the pandemic. And so naturally, those peripheral friendships also fell by the wayside. Life happens. Yeah. I do know that he is still part of the religious community that discourages non-secular content. And I know he's had a couple of kids in that time as well. So I have no idea if he has since watched other movies. That said, I am still connected to him on social media. I've shot him a message asking for an update and will gladly report back if/when I hear from him. Social media.
Guy doesn't watch a film for his entire adult life, but he's on Instagram.
He's on Instagram seeing us be like, into the Spider-Verse, blah, blah, blah.
They're like mini movies on Instagram. Yes, mate. Yes, they are.
Cheers, guys, and long live the king, T'Challa, obviously, not Charles.
Yes. Trevor, always great to hear
Trevor,
from you.
Thank you so much.
Our LA correspondent. The fact that, LA, that's where they make movies.
That's where they
the
make
fact that
them.
Someone's written from there, it's like, LA.
LA.
Okay, this next email is called Book to Film, and it's from, I want to say, Huel.
Spelled H-Y-W-E-L.
I'm going to say Huel.
Can't be Hywel.
No, I think this is a Welsh name. I'm going to just take a stab and say that's a Welsh name.
I hope it is, because as Huel says, hi guys, I'm a long time listener,
yes.
Love the pod, and can always take a review of yours in good faith, as I'm always enjoying your takes on films I've also recently seen. That's great to know.
I don't want to be shithouse reviews.
I wonder if you also disliked Hacksaw Ridge. Anyway, you mentioned recently the Spooks book series. Yes.
This has come up a few times.
Quite happy because I've never met anyone who's also read them. And like, there's a community.
I think that's the third email about the Spook. Yeah.
Good. Not to be confused with the British TV show about spies. Yeah. It was a series I loved to read, which had me taking a curious glance at the bookcase in my old room when visiting home last weekend. Nice. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, running your fingers along the spines.
Yeah.
Slipping through my fingers.
All the books in my child bookshop are just kids' books.
Yeah.
Because like they filled up the space and I've not replaced them. It's just like they'll just forever be
Guinness Book of Records from like 2005.
Oh, yeah. Everything I Know About Science.
I came across a series looking at the bookshelf, I actually came across a series I pitched as a possible book-to-script project as some coursework at university, which is Darren Shan's Demon Artist series. Yes, I know this very well. Darren had his other big IP, the vampire series, which was made into the film Cirque de Freak a few years ago, which fell staggeringly short of the huge fan base the books had amassed. And yeah, that film like fell on its face. But I do remember Cirque de Freak as well. I think the Demon Artist series is held back by this flop and would make an even better film, in my opinion, possibly even a big budget series. Wondering if you guys are aware of this work and agree. I'm also still reading at the fact that they're thinking about touching the Harry Potter series. Again, love the show. Keep up the great work. So, Huel, on the Demon Artist, yes, I used to read those books. I used to love them. I never read the Cirque de Freak stuff, but the Demon Artist is like very gory stories about a demon underworld. And like the first story is like, it's called like Lord Lost. It's got something to do with like a werewolf. And then the second book comes in and it's a different character. And it's a guy who can move through dimensions, a bit like a multiverse, move through the demon dimension with portals. And it ends with this really good twist. And like, oh no, like a sad reveal at the end of it. I remember it's the green one, Colonel Fleck. Oh my God, all these names are coming back to me. And then the third one, it's back to the character we met in the first book, and that's really cool. And then the fourth one is like set somewhere completely different, and it's like in the wildlands, and only about like halfway through do you realize it's set in 5th century Ireland. I know. And you're like, wow, this is amazing. And it goes, I used to always love those books.
There's clearly an appetite. I hope some big wig producer with access to all the IP is going to manifest this research.
Here's what I'm worried about though, is that the way that the demons are described in the book is like, they're so like amorphous and like have different things. And it's just so gory as well that I'm almost wondering, like in a book, it sounds great. But if you put that on screen, all it takes is one slightly dodgy VFX job. And it's just killed the whole thing. So, it's almost, I don't know how that would look good on screen.
Yeah.
However good the source material is.
This next one is from Sam. Friend of the show, Sam.
Oh, yes.
Yes, friend of the show. Lots of love on Instagram from Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
I noticed when you give love on social media, by the way, guys.
Yeah.
It gets you fast-tracked to be friend of the show, I will just say. He says, hello, lads.
Hello, Pope. We have some new friend of the show requests. Yeah. Ah, not many partridges. Yeah. Sirens are on around. Thank you.
In a stack of paperwork getting approved. Hello, lads. Long-time listener and first-time emailer. I'm a delivery driver from Guernsey. Yes, Guernsey, not Jersey. And love listening to your pod while trying my hardest not to get bitten by dogs.
Okay. Great. I'm sorry to hear about the dogs. Yes. We should explain to our international audience, this will confuse the hell out of them,
go on,
about the relationship of Jersey and Guernsey, which are the Channel Islands,
okay,
which are not part of the UK, but technically are British. They're like a British... they're actually classed as a Ballywick, I think. I don't know if that's the way you pronounce it, because the person who used to run it was a Lord Bailiff, and they're actually very close
very
to...
Very interesting flags.
Very interesting. They're very close to France. Actually, it's Jersey, Guernsey, and... Where's Bergerac set? The other one. Oh, yeah. There's also, Alderney and Sark. That's it. And anyway, they are... It's just very interesting. It's like a classic like
British
thing of like an old history.
Would very love to correct you.
Very technical thing where it's like, well, actually, no, they're not part of the United Kingdom and they're actually part of it, but they are British. And
someone's explaining to you the difference between Britain and the United Kingdom, and you're like, well, technically the landmass of Britain. And you're like, oh my God, I don't even know why it's called this.
Yeah. And even you saying that makes me want to jump in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm so tempted.
Because you're that person.
We haven't even talked about the Isle of Man. No. Okay, but yes, sorry, back to our dear friend
Sam, who says, I'm a delivery driver from Guernsey. Yes, Guernsey, not Jersey.
Yes.
I'd love listening to your pod whilst trying my hardest to not get bitten by dogs.
Yes, yes.
It's like the classic post-delivery driver problem.
They can be, you know, awful.
You've got to hope people put beware of the dog. But you never know.
Try the owner.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like to say, I stopped watching films over the last few years and your pod is a massive reason to why I've started watching lots of films again. And it's really improved my anxiety and mental health. So thank you very much.
Oh,
kiss.
That's
Sam.
That's great. I'm sorry to hear you stop watching them at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome back. Lots of people saying the podcast, bring them back.
Join us, guys, at the table.
My question is, were you shown any films when you were far too young? For example, my dad showed me and my brother Saving Private Ryan when my mum was away. Classic dad.
Yeah.
Classic dad.
It's educational. It's history.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I need to see it. It's classic. I was in year 3, brackets 7 or 8 years old, and my brother was 9. I also watched Taxi Driver when I was 11 and didn't realise that Jodie Foster was a sex worker.
Quite a big plot detail.
Quite a big sort of motivational
thing. Why is
he
hanging around with this girl so much?
Where are parents? Sorry for the long email or any spelling mistakes or grammatical errors. I'm dyslexic, lol. Lots of love, Sam, sent from my iPad.
Interesting. Also, people are very apologetic about their, like, I know we had very good spelling. Formatted email from Bennett last week, but like, you know, you guys are fine. It's okay.
You guys are fine.
Although if you do include errors, we will read them out as written. That's what we tend to do. That question though, have you seen something too young?
I've mentioned this before and it's really like, I think it was about whether or not that really boosted your impression of a film. And I remember when I saw The Matrix really young and I was like, oh my God, like it's an 18 and it's like really violent. And that was just like this whole world that it's a film I wasn't allowed to see. That really enhanced it for me.
But I do remember, I was shown films quite young.
Yeah.
By my dad, who I think, not like a problematic way, he would always watch them with me and explain. And
like change the radiator.
They would do things where like, you know, they would show me adult stuff, but they would like, you know, he would pause it where appropriate. He would either skip through a sex scene or pause where he gets fired and explain adult things. You'd be like, do you understand why that's happened? Or do you understand when that's bad? And I honestly think it happened because my dad was like, I want to watch a film, but I'm so tired of watching children's films.
Yes.
Can't I just watch an adult film and just explain to the child
you don't
why
want
I'm
to see
doing
me.
This?
You're like,
There's two films I have an answer for this. Well, first of all, I remember seeing, honestly, before I was 10, I remember seeing Alien, Jaws,
Alien I saw young.
But I was not a Terminator. I mean, the first Terminator is really bloody as well when he's like going on. But like, none of that messed me up. I loved Aliens.
I watched Terminator really young. My grandma was like, oh, you'll love Terminator.
But it didn't mess me up. I saw Jaws very young as well. But the two films that did were
I saw Alien when I was 8, I think.
Yeah, so I watched The Godfather when I was 9.
Yeah.
I kind of wasted on you. But I remember getting to, again, because my parents love, it's like their favourite film, they're probably like, well, we want to watch The Godfather. I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah.
I remember getting to the bit with the horse's head, which is a real horse's head, as we now know. And it's the way that scene is shot, and it's the, you know, the creeping strings and the way he pulls back the satin sheets with the blood. And it's like the scream as he sees this thing. It's horrifying. And I fucking scared the shit out of me. I couldn't watch the rest of The Godfather. And I remember going to bed that night, really struggled to sleep, and I would not. I remember getting like severe cramp and pins and needles because I would not stretch my legs out to the bottom of my bed because I thought there was a horse's head there. So I had to like tuck them up. So there's that. I also got scared by Ghostbusters actually, but anyway. But the other big one was The Shining, and I think I mentioned this before. It was like I'd seen The Shining, like
that's really disturbing.
Oh, completely.
How old?
I was 10.
Yeah.
And I was
young.
But it's my fault. It's my fault because I had seen it talked about in like these best films of all times. I was like, and I'd seen it referenced in Treehouse of Horror. And I was aware it was iconic. And I was like, oh, I really want to see that. The Shining. I was on to my parents about it for ages. And then I remember, I think I've told this before, but finally it was on one time on Sky Movies. So I was like, look, I really want to watch it. They're like, okay, you want to watch The Shining? Because they'd never seen it. They're like, you want to watch The Shining? Okay, we'll watch The Shining. So we all sit down to watch it.
I think you told the
story. Yeah, and I do. And I get to the bit with the twins. And I'm like,
what about the woman in the bath?
That's way after the twins.
That fucked me up.
I was stuck to the twins and I got completely terrified. And then my parents were like, yep, there you go.
It's also like a young boy exploring a hotel. It's very much like a scenario that could be alone in a hallway.
It's horrible. And I returned to it, I want to say, when I was 18, 8 years later. And I had to watch it during the day. And I had to keep pausing it and playing Magic Moments by Perry Como, which is the
just to take you out of the.
I needed something cheery, which is ridiculous because I don't think it would scare me.
You
now.
Saying that just reminded me. I watched Psycho very young.
Oh right.
My dad put it on, and me and my sister watched. I think it was like it's like summer holiday, and it was on Sky, and he was like, "Oh, you should watch this. It's great." And I don't think we asked if it was scary. And Psycho's, and he started it with us, but then just like got distracted and left. And it was just me and my sister watching Psycho. And that film starts very slowly, and there's a sense of unease, but nothing that horrifying really. Sort of had a sense that this is the film, but I remember we just completely couldn't take our eyes off it. Yeah. That's the only time I've seen it.
Maybe that's like the other question about not wanting to spoil that experience.
Yes, and I remember we both just thought, wow, this is like really, really good. But then the just sort of going into the house was just so gothic and horrible. Yeah. And then the scene at the end was terrible. But I just thinking you mentioned scenes your parents made you fast forward. I have an older sister who's 8 years older than me, so getting Titanic on VHS was a really big deal.
The bubs.
Obviously, gonna want to watch that. Enjoyed it as a kid, but car scene, I didn't know what was going on. I just saw hands being swept across. We just didn't really notice. And then I was allowed to watch the scene with the drawing.
Yeah.
Which is art, because that's art.
Nice.
But I
nice
remember one, like parents. Really watching that and being like, this is weird. Yeah. Like, why is this? Like, you can't make sense of it, but it's there.
Also, to bring this sort of conversation full circle to what we're talking about at the beginning of the show, just talking about horror films and my dad. I remember last year when we watched The Exorcist, I was talking to my dad about it because that is the film that he's always said scared the hell out of him when he was a kid. Yes. Right? Or not kid, younger. And Psycho was the one that scared my mum. And I was talking to my dad about it. I was like, oh, because I finally watched it. And my dad was like, oh, and my dad, it's like 50 years ago, man.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, oh, yeah, we saw it. It like we were like 17. We'd gone down to like Southampton to see a football game, and we watched the football game. And afterwards, there was a huge like brawl. There was a huge fight. So they went in the cinema to get away from the fight. Mm. Him and his friends, and they were like, well, "What's showing? What's on?" They're like, "The Exorcist." Oh, right. And I just remember my dad being like, "Oh yeah, ooh, that bit where her head spins round. Oh god."
I just remember I watched The Omen very young.
That's the one I've not seen. Yeah,
I've seen the Omen again, like that's just at home. Again, my dad putting it on and not just having any sense of that. And then Signs.
Yes,
because it's a 12.
Yeah, yeah.
At the time, you think how scary or traumatizing could a 12 be? But I remember being very young watching that and the found footage scene in Signs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really that's a really good scare the alien.
If you're 10, it's a good scare.
I still think it's good. I think it holds up. Go and watch the found footage scene from Signs and enjoy the scare. Guys, there are so many more emails to read out. We are going to do our best to get to them, but please do keep sending them in. We love to read them out.
We love a great... What we love about the emails is they're always interesting and they're sent from so many different people.
And just that conversation.
World,
and thinking about all the films I watched too young.
Yeah.
And,
brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic.
Amazing. Thank you
guys,
so much.
If you want to send your email in, please do send them to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com and we'll read them out on the show. But George, before we... send it home. Let's play a game.
Yes.
You look very confused there.
Because I was like, do we not send it home with a game?
We do.
We are doing the games before we
I'm
send
actually
it home.
Who is sending the game?
Before the roll the B-roll.
Okay, so George, it's that time of the episode where we wind down, we play some games, a little bit of trivia, a little bit of fun facts, a little bit of throwing some tension things back and forth. You and I have played a game on this podcast many times called... cast list countdown.
We've played it many times, but you couldn't remember the title.
The reason why is because I've invented a new game called Co-Star Countdown.
Oh, okay.
And then how this works is I'm going to give you an actor and I'm going to read out their co-stars. And as I read out their co-stars, you have to tell me what film they were in together.
Okay, I like
today's actor is the one and only Morgan Freeman.
Right.
Extensive backlog filmography. So I'm going to, as I said, I will read out co-stars, and as I read them out, you have to tell me what film they were in together. Do you understand?
I believe I do, yes.
Okay. So, George, are you ready? You have to guess the film from Morgan Freeman's co-star.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1. Brad Pitt.
7.
Yes. Matt Damon. Rugby.
Invictus,
yes.
Thank you.
Jimon Hounsou.
I don't know.
Amistad, hot. Monica Potter.
Along Came a Spider?
Yes. Kevin Costner. Robs of the Rich.
Robin Hood.
Yes, Prince of Thieves. Hilary Swank.
It's not. Boys Don't Cry. It's not. Million Dollar Baby.
Yes. Ashley Judd.
That I thought that was. Along Came a Spider. It's shattered. Something broken. Glass.
Kiss the Girls.
Oh.
Tim Robbins.
Shawshank. The Redemption.
Ben Affleck.
Gone Baby Gone. Well, he is in that with him.
I think that counts. Yes, yeah. I'll give you. Robert Duvall. Not Armageddon.
Deep Impact.
Yes. Jessica Tandy.
This is so hard. Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes, last one. Jim Carrey. Come on. Jim Carrey.
Bruce Almighty.
Oh my God.
Of all the ones, I thought you'd get that.
Hard. It is hard. That is hard.
Bastard.
There you go. That was co-star countdown.
How was it that the only one I got was the one with the co-star who I didn't recognize?
I know, like you managed to get. Did you get? No, you didn't get. Alistair.
No.
You got Along Came a Spider
and Shawshank.
And Shawshank.
Seven.
Is that all you got?
That's it.
Well done. It's hard. And there are only so many actors you can do that with.
Samuel L. Jackson
would be another one, but. Samuel Jackson is also hard because he does a lot of small characters in very big franchises with lots of actors in them.
I think you've got to do Morgan Marvel. Freeman. You have a no Marvel rule for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, you'd have to be more selective.
You didn't even put Batman
Jackson.
In there.
No.
Okay, next.
That was good.
Or right. Now you see me,
yeah.
That would have been
good. Yeah, I mean, I could do him again.
No, it's fine. How funny.
Okay.
Are you going to do that again with a different actor now?
No. This is a new game. I'm going to do two rounds of this.
Okay.
This is very simple. You have to guess the film from the number in the title, right? So I'm going to tell you a number and you have to tell me what film it is.
Okay.
So like the number is in the title. Ready? You have to guess the film from the number in its title. Ready? 3, 2, 1. 2001.
A Space Odyssey.
127.
Hours.
17.
Again.
12.
Angry Man.
10,000.
Years BC.
Yeah, just BC, yeah. 47.
Meters down.
I'll accept that. Ronin was the answer. 28.
Days later.
0.
Dark 30.
21.
Jump Street.
3.
100.
Yeah, that'll answer. No.
Okay, 3.
Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. 2.
2.
Two.
Two. Two. Fast. Two Furious.
Yes. One.
100 Dalmatians.
No.
One. 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 One.
Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
You broke my brain.
One day.
One.
One fine morning. All right, we've got another round of that. You ready?
That's really hard. Okay.
It is hard. You like how I went 3, 2, 1 towards the end?
Yeah. God.
Ready? Next round. Guess the film from the number in its title. 101.
Dalmatians.
8.
Legged Freaks.
Yes. 7.
Pounds.
Yes. 9.
There are two films called 9, but no. You need the 9 in the title. 9. The whole 9 yards.
Yes. 13.
Going on 30.
Yes. 40.
Year old virgin.
Yes. 50.
First dates.
Yes. 60.
66.
Gone in 60 seconds. 500.
Days of Summer.
Last one. 4.
4.
just tell me. Just tell
weddings
me.
And a funeral is what you can do.
It's hard,
that's
isn't it?
That's really, come on.
It's kind of confusing. And just when you think about one number, I'm throwing you the next number. And obviously,
No, please stop. 77.
Guys, there you go. Those were the game's little brain ticklers for you there. Guys, thank you.
I'm going to get you get back me next so time. Much.
Well, there you go, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Pop Kitchen. Thank you so much for being here. Don't forget, we post new episodes of the show every single Wednesday.
And as mentioned earlier in the show, we have bonus content coming out during the week. We've got our Succession thoughts. We have James's thoughts on The Irishman. He finally watched it. Also, keep your eyes on our Instagram and TikTok. We do post interesting things throughout the week. You would have known if you follow us that we asked for people's thoughts on the Succession finale, which we're going to read out in our discussion about it. That's great. And as ever, just continue to like, subscribe, review, rate, support, share. We really appreciate
Guys,
it. It really helps
please,
us.
Please, if you could give us a review on the app that you're listening now or watching, it's like literally takes you 5 seconds. You scroll with your thumb and do it. And it helps people find the show. People are finding it on streaming, on what are they called? Music services.
Music streaming platforms?
Music streaming platforms. So please, if they see good reviews, it helps the show grow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
See you in a couple of days for some bonus content.